reporting, Trump envoy Tom Barrack admits Israel bombed the global Samud flotilla ships in Tunisia earlier this month. That's where Greta was speaking. We're talking to live on the ship, David Adler, co-general coordinator of the Progressive International.
So, David Adler, just before we finish, if you could say, what exactly are you carrying on the ship to Gaza, and what are you calling for now?
We are carrying these ships. Some of them are humble motor cruisers like the family boat where I'm stationed, the lead vessel of the broader fleet. Some of them are even humbler sailing boats, are packed to the gills with basic and critical humanitarian aid, baby formula, medicine, food, and water. However, we're not naive about the scale of the suffering in Gaza and the scale of the humanitarian crisis that requires a much larger and more ambitious response by the states, whose good faith obligations under international law require them to respond under the Genocide Convention. So that's why I put so much emphasis on this infrastructural element of our mission. We are not here to drop the aid and go home and pat ourselves on the back.
We have 5 seconds, David.
We are here to establish a humanitarian corridor for states themselves to assume their responsibilities and to deliver the aid at the scale that Gaza requires.
David Adler, co-general coordinator of Progressive International, one of the people on board the Samud flotilla headed to break the siege in Gaza. Spanish and Italian naval ships have gone to protect them. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Listen to Armando Puentes every Sunday from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., playing the best in Tejano mixing with some traditional conjunto, as well as mariachi music and public affairs pertaining to the Latino community. That's Armando Puentes, only on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's camping ban will be enforced starting November 1st. Portlanders support moves by City Council to strengthen sanctuary city commitments, and National Public Lands Day is celebrated on Saturday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 25th, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson says police will start ticketing homeless Portlanders again starting November 1st. The city's homeless camping ban has not been enforced through ticketing or arrests since February. Homeless Portlanders can be ticketed for camping on public property if they've been offered a reasonable shelter. Those who get a ticket will be warrant checked by police, however. Wilson said he's not been enforcing the policy while he's focused on bringing more overnight shelters online. He's been able to add 630 more overnight shelter beds for a total of around 3,000, but there are still an estimated 6,000 unhoused Portlanders on the streets every night. Wilson told Oregon Live, quote, "We cannot arrest our way out of homelessness, nor should we. We must, however, return to enforcing our existing codes on open drug use, illegal dumping, blocked right-of-way, fire, and other sanitation and quality of life issues," end quote. Meanwhile, the city is facing an $11 million shortfall in their homeless shelter budget. Wilson promised state lawmakers would support the city with $11 million for shelters, but that didn't get passed this session, and lawmakers don't come back into session until early next year. A memo from City Administrator Michael Jordan says the city must embark on a, quote, reimagination of the best use of funds. Portland City Councilors are moving towards strengthening the city's sanctuary status. At the Community and Public Safety Committee meeting on Tuesday, Councilor Samir Canal presented a proposal to take the city's sanctuary resolution and turn it into an actual ordinance.
First, I want to discuss why this matters. In 2017, City Council adopted Resolution 37277, which declared that Portland is a sanctuary city. It had no formal force of law. Resolutions are a statement of opinion. It did require that the Portland Police Bureau incorporate this into its directives, and PPB did, but no other part of the city has this requirement. Ordinances, by contrast, create law. Law has to be changed in public by city council. The state's Sanctuary Promise Act created binding law at the state level, but the city has not done so. And by contrast, executive orders can be time-bound or revoked by future mayors without a public process. They're helpful for indicating how the city will implement a law, but they're not really designed for or sufficient for creating that binding long-term public commitment in the first place. So the key components of this ordinance are, one, elevate our sanctuary status from non-binding city resolution to city law. This will extend the requirement of not doing the work of federal immigration enforcement, which currently is primarily focused on PPB, to all city employees, facilities, and money. It will define public spaces within city buildings as compared to some that are for authorized personnel only, which helps convey information to the public and city employees about where a judicial warrant or a city badge is required to enter. It will require that the administration finds a way to ensure that all city staff know their responsibilities and are able to fulfill them. That might include revising existing trainings and establishing notification processes. And finally, it directs the city to initiate Freedom of Information or FOIA Act requests to get information about the federal government's activities in Portland. Portlanders deserve to know who is in our community and what they're doing.
City employees from Latinx PDX, an employee research group, called on the city council and the mayor to take immediate action to protect workers and the community. Ana Maria Perez is the co-chair of the group.
Since the new federal administration took office in January, Latinx PDX has been advocating for, at a minimum, the city to acknowledge the pain and terror that Latinx and immigrant communities or immigrant employees are experiencing, and at best protecting us as workers and people. Even though Oregon is a sanctuary state and the city of Portland passed a resolution declaring us a sanctuary city, there is a lack of clarity on what a sanctuary status really means in practice. This is why we at Latinx PDX are deeply appreciative that this draft ordinance has detailed and will put into city code many of our demands that will positively impact the community. First, requiring city employees to be accurately and regularly trained makes everyone in our city safer. City employees work all over the city, all day and all week, and having us ready and equipped to follow sanctuary law and potential code is essential to protecting community members and for protecting ourselves and our colleagues. Adding clear signage to all city buildings provides employees and the public with necessary information to distinguish where federal immigration agents can or cannot enter. Submitting regular Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests about DHS and ICE activities shows that our city holds federal entities accountable on our streets. Regular reporting and documentation of immigration enforcement activity in our city shows the community that we care enough to simply pay attention.
Canal has two other ordinances in the works as well. One would prohibit law enforcement from obscuring their faces. They must have visible identification. Another would ban the use of chemical weapons or tear gas on Portlanders. He says they're under review from city attorneys and getting input from Portland police right now, so they're not before the council yet. Portland police say enforcing a mask ban on ICE officers or a requirement that police check identification of these officers is not something they have the authority to do. Canal disagrees, saying there are a few paths to being able to enforce that, but one of those could be through a court order. Written and oral testimony overwhelmingly supported City Council taking more serious action on its sanctuary status. Many expressed specific support for banning ICE agents from wearing masks, an ordinance that's still in its early stages.
Two fathers have been snatched from my neighborhood, plus a third person while waiting for the kids to get out of school in the past week. No one is safe. We need to take action now as a community and stand on our values and have a constitutional right to due process.
The cruel irony is those who support ICE claim they make our neighborhoods safe from criminals, even as ICE conceals their identities while committing damning crimes against constitutional laws and human rights. When ICE violates the rights and freedoms of our neighbors, they declare open season on the rights and freedoms of all of us. For this reason, I appreciate all the time and labor that went into making our city's sanctuary laws more concrete.
I'm here to testify in support of unmasking them. I'm here to testify in support of doing something to stop them polluting our city, and to speak out for people who, you know, aren't necessarily safe to come here.
At this moment, we have the opportunity to use every single tool in the toolbox to make and keep our community safe. Resolution, ordinances, executive order, you name it. All are important. This ordinance transforms that intent into enforceable law. It ensures that all city bureaus, not just the police bureau, are guided by clear and consistent rules, that employees do not engage in immigration enforcement, that training is provided, and that every bureau has a designated liaison to support this work.
Finally, with this ordinance, a light is shining on where we can and must do better. Updated protocols, training for all staff, signage for non-public areas, immigrant affairs liaisons, working in true partnership with community organizations like Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, PERC. These initiatives must be implemented.
No one should have to fear that a lunch break or commute home could change their life forever. Yet, for many city employees and community members, that fear is real.
Councillor Angelita Murillo is working on proposals of her own. One proposal would require an extra fee from federal authorities leasing space in the city. If passed, it could be used to pay police overtime, pay for traffic control and environmental cleanup that result from federal agents interacting with protesters. She's also proposing that the city do more to protect people's data privacy under increasing government surveillance. The main sanctuary ordinance drafted by Councillor Canal will likely be back before the Community and Public Safety Committee at their next meeting on October 7th. Later this evening, activists with the Filipino group Bayan Oregon will be rallying at Terry Shrunk Plaza at 6 p.m. against corruption in the Philippines. I spoke with Inez, a member of Bayan Oregon's regional council, to learn more about the protest.
We are holding a rally against the corrupt and fascist system in the Philippines. Last September 21st, 200,000 angry Filipinos took to the streets for the 53rd anniversary of martial law in the Philippines. They were demanding justice for billions of pesos stolen from the people to build sham flood projects that did not actually help protect the people from floods and typhoons. They were just meant to fill the pockets of bureaucrat capitalists in the government. So we are echoing that anger as fellow Filipinos.
Who should come to this event?
Anybody who is enraged by corruption and bureaucrat capitalism and fascism in the government, in the Philippines and in the U.S. We're seeing it in the way that migrants and workers are being targeted by this administration with labor exploitation, with violence, with detentions and deportations. It's all the same system that's causing so much oppression upon the people. So anybody who is against that is welcome to join us at 6 p.m.
Do you have any final words for us? Anything we didn't mention?
Yes, there are ways to continue this fight. After today, we are continuing to discuss these root problems and these issues that oppress our people. Tomorrow, we have an educational discussion, Migrants Over Profit, the Political Economy of Detention Facilities. That will be from 6 to 9 p.m. You can follow Bayan Oregon on Instagram and Facebook for more updates on both these events.
That was Inez with Bayan Oregon speaking with me about a rally planned for this evening at Terry Shrunk Plaza at 6 p.m. against corruption in the Philippines. Republicans slam the shooting at an ICE facility in Texas, calling for an end to political violence. Trump is found to have illegally fired federal watchdogs, and Democrats blame Republicans for the looming government shutdown. With those stories and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
To every politician who is using rhetoric, demonizing ICE and demonizing CBP, stop. To every politician demanding that ICE agents be doxxed and calling for people to go after their families, stop. This has very real consequences.
After defending free speech of a late-night comic, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is calling for cooling the rhetoric on immigration officers. Three people were shot, two fatally, at a Dallas ICE detention center. The FBI released a picture of an unspent bullet casing found at the scene with the words anti-ICE written on it. All those shot were detainees, not immigration officers. The sniper apparently died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Democrats say political violence is unacceptable, but argue Cruz is distorting their resistance to ICE. The FBI announced yesterday that they had found classified documents in former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton's D.C. office. The neoconservative has become a fierce critic of President Donald Trump, but media reports say his careless handling of secrets may have revealed them to foreign actors. A federal judge has ruled that Trump illegally fired 20 inspectors general, but allowed the firings to stand. The judge ruled that Trump did not provide the required notice to Congress before firing the watchdogs, but if they're reinstated, could begin the process at any time. The sides are jockeying over who gets the blame for a government shutdown expected in a week. Republicans are backing a clean continuing resolution to fund the government at current levels until mid-November. Democrats are demanding Congress reverse cuts to Medicaid and extend subsidies for ACA plans. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Trump has canceled a meeting to negotiate.
Republicans have clearly demonstrated they want to shut the government down. Throughout this process, an intentional decision was made by Republican leadership in the House and the Senate not to have a single conversation with Democrats. They're not even pretending as if they want to find common ground.
Trump is expected to sign an agreement to transfer ownership of China-based social media company TikTok to a group of American investors. A bipartisan law forcing the sale of the video platform with 170 million users here followed warnings it could be a national security risk. Former Democratic Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger is being endorsed for governor by the Virginia Police Benevolent Association. Spanberger is a centrist who has worked as a CIA officer. Rich Gosko with the association says they are hoping to gain collective bargaining rights that they now lack.
With police officers who've got to adhere to strict policies and laws and all this framework in their job, but they don't get any say into their employment. And what they're looking for is to have a contract that they can look at.
Spanberger's Republican opponent, Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earle Sears, was endorsed by the association when running for her current office. The lieutenant governor says police should get a targeted tax break. At a UN climate summit, China is pledging to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 7 to 10% in a decade, expanding renewables sixfold and making electric cars common. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Americans are streaming newly released movies more and going to the theater less. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more about the results of a new poll just released by the Associated Press.
A recent poll shows Americans are more likely to watch newly released movies at home instead of going to the theater. About three-quarters of U.S. adults said they watched a new movie via streaming instead of at the theater at least once in the past year. This was according to a survey from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Some 3 in 10 said they watched new movies by streaming at least once a month. About two-thirds of Americans said they watched a recently released movie at the theater in the past year, but only 16% said they went at least once a month. The trend accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic and thereafter. Convenience and cost are apparently both factors in the decision to stream rather than head out to the theater. Also, films end up on streaming services much more quickly these days. In 2017, a 90-day exclusive theatrical window was common. Now, theaters are fighting to have an industry-wide standard of only 45 days. The strategy does seem to vary for every movie. This year's Best Picture winner, Anora, had a 70-day exclusive theatrical window. Wicked was available to purchase on demand only 40 days after opening in theaters. Surprisingly, availability by streaming does not seem to significantly decrease box office sales. There is still a bit of overlap between theatergoers and people who like to stream. 55% of U.S. adults have seen a new movie in a theater and also streamed at least once in the past year. In addition, the widespread availability of services that can be streamed over the web, including Netflix and Hulu, means many Americans don't have cable anymore, either. Seeing movies in a theater is expensive. The average cost of a movie ticket in the U.S. is $13.17, and everyone in the family has to buy a ticket, versus paying the same amount for something streamed, no matter how many watch it at the same time. The poll showed those with higher incomes are more likely to be at least occasional moviegoers for new releases. New movies are more popular among young adults regardless of how they are viewed. But streaming is accessed more by the younger generation. Slightly less than half of adults under age 30 say they watched a recently released movie on streaming instead of going to the theater at least once a month in the past year. That compares with about 2 in 10 who watched a movie in the theater with that frequency. However, there has been rising interest in seeing certain films in IMAX or on other premium format screens. The North American box office is currently up more than 4% from last year, but it is still down more than 22% from pre-pandemic levels. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on autism and maternal medication use. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 32 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a daytime high of 73. Today in history, in 1789, the U.S. Congress passes the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. They guarantee specific personal freedoms, like the freedom of speech, the right to publish, to privacy, the right to practice religion, to possess firearms, and to assemble, among other natural and legal rights. The quote of the day is from actor and activist Christopher Reeve, known for playing Superman, who was born on this day in 1952. He said, quote, "So many of our dreams at first seem impossible, then they seem improbable, and then, when we summon the will, they will soon become inevitable." A new guide out of the Great Lakes helps instruct local governments on how to adapt to climate change. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A resource guide to help small and medium-sized governments in the Great Lakes region adapt to climate change has been published. Chuck Kornbach reports that some tribal communities in the area are already trying to reduce problems caused by higher temperatures and additional flooding.
The guide is from the International Joint Commission, or IJC, which helps implement the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 between the U.S. and Canada. Liz Kirkwood of the IJC's Water Quality Board says climate change has brought more severe storms, loss of ice cover, and extreme temperatures to much of North America, including the Great Lakes region.
In 2024, extreme weather disasters cost the 8 Great Lakes states more than $13 billion U.S. dollars combined. Some of the costliest disasters happened in the last 5 years.
While debate continues over how to reduce air pollution that contributes to climate change, the IJC has published a guide aimed at helping small and medium-sized governments adapt to the new temperatures and heavier rainfalls. Charlie Rasmussen of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says his organization welcomes the sharing of best practices, funding ideas, and other strategies. He says the commission's 11 Ojibwe member tribes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota are already taking steps, sometimes in collaboration with local, state, or federal agencies. One project being Ishkaday. That's using prescribed or controlled fires on land next to water.
They help maintain and reestablish native species that do the best job at holding the soil and able to resist, you know, some of these severe precipitation events.
Rasmussen says other tribes are putting in larger roadside culverts to reduce highway damage from flooding and to help wildlife move. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
This academic year in North Dakota, eighth graders are getting new textbooks that'll educate them about the five tribes that are found within the state. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, this is a series that's being revised for the first time in 30 years.
Originally, four texts and a journal were printed between 1995 and 2002. Much of the content came from interviews with tribal elders in the 1970s. This new series will still feature books on the Spirit Lake Oyate, Standing Rock Oyate, Turtle Mountain Ojibwe, and the three affiliated tribes or Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, or MHA. But a new edition on the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate has been added, and each tribe had exclusive editorial control over their respective book, which included more recent historical information.
It's so important that Indigenous peoples are represented in a contemporary sense.
Sashay Shetler is an MHA citizen and the assistant director of North Dakota's Office of Indigenous and Multicultural Education. She recalls classmates growing up who thought Native people were extinct.
Then you have people getting elected into positions and if you have somebody thinking that Indigenous peoples don't exist, they're going to make policies that aren't bettering our communities for everyone.
5% of North Dakota's population is Native American. Nick Asbury is a former employee of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction who has remained active in promoting the books.
It's important that we have the platform for the nations to tell their own story because kids are smart. They know when something is authentic and when it's not.
An original overview entitled Journey to Understanding, An Introduction to North Dakota Tribes, is still part of the set. Besides eighth graders, people can download the set for free or order a published copy online. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Georgia's data center boom is prompting calls for stronger state oversight. Environmental advocates warn unchecked growth could worsen air pollution and strain local resources unless new rules are adopted. Shantia Hudson has more on the story.
Data centers are rapidly expanding across Georgia, and environmental advocates are raising concerns about their impact on nearby communities. The Sierra Club is urging the Georgia Department of Community Affairs to step up oversight through its Developmental of Regional Impact Review process, which lets local governments and residents weigh in on large projects. The agency temporarily paused reviews for data centers earlier this year to update outdated rules and now plans to resume reviews for certain facilities based on their size. Sierra Club staff attorney Isabella Ariza explains their biggest concern is the facility's reliance on diesel-powered generators for backup power, which she calls one of the most dangerous sources of air pollution.
So imagine that all of these data centers need to turn on their diesel generators at the same time. Since many of them are located in the metro Atlanta area, that will likely impact air quality.
Ariza explains the goal is transparency, pointing out that Georgia has never done a cumulative impact study to show how diesel emissions affect air people breathe. She notes the number of diesel generators can vary widely depending on location, with some sites having as few as 6, with others more than 180. That means some neighborhoods could face much heavier pollution than others. Researchers warn the widespread use of diesel generators could carry an annual price tag of $136 million in medical costs tied to heart attacks, hospital visits, and premature deaths. Ariza adds the Sierra Club is also asking the DCA to recommend battery storage as a cleaner backup power option and to require stronger monitoring of data center projects and their impacts.
He suggests that DCA also tracks information submitted by data centers and include a report with what they gather in their submission to local authorities. That way, we can better track how many data centers are coming to a particular location.
Ariza says that water usage is another pressing concern, with some data centers drawing millions of gallons to keep servers cool. She encourages Georgians to speak up by commenting on Environmental Protection Division permit applications and taking part in county zoning meetings. She says it's important projects remain transparent and community needs are considered. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson.
Climate scientists are giving more credence to the idea of solar geoengineering during New York City Climate Week. It involves reflecting a small percentage of the sun's light back into space to achieve global cooling. While scientists are only advocating for more research at this time, this could be another tool to fight climate change in the future. Edwin J. Vieira has the details.
As part of New York City Climate Week, scientists are examining an overlooked idea to fight climate change, solar geoengineering. This involves reflecting about 1% of sunlight from the stratosphere back into space to ease some of the worst effects of global warming. While research has been ongoing for several decades, scientists still don't fully understand solar geoengineering's viability. But Phil Duffy with Spark Climate Solutions says there's one common idea of how it would work.
The most commonly discussed approach would be to put small, very, very, very small reflected particles in the stratosphere, and that could reflect just a little bit more sunlight back into space and have a significant cooling effect.
He notes large volcanic eruptions already put these particles in the stratosphere. Currently, about 30% of the sun's radiation is reflected into space by clouds, sea ice, and other particles, according to the World Meteorological Organization. Scientists aren't calling for deployment of solar geoengineering, but rather for more research into it. While the idea gains traction as another weapon in the fight against climate change, scientists worldwide are working to understand what gaps in research remain. New York's Cornell University and the University of Buffalo are both researching solar geoengineering. Ben Kravitz with Indiana University says groups like the NGO Reflective are considering the broader effects.
So
So is it that we need to understand how those microscopic particles grow and interact with the atmosphere, things like that? If I had to put something at the top of my list, it would be how would this affect ecosystems? And in turn, how would climate change affect ecosystems?
While some scientists consider it a promising idea, solar geoengineering faces opposition. Three states have enacted laws banning geoengineering research, while similar bills failed in 30 other states, including New York. Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced the Clear Skies Act to ban cloud seeding and solar geoengineering research nationwide. While some experts view it as an emergency option, Michael Thompson with the Alliance for Just Deliberation on Solar Geoengineering says that's a dangerous framework.
When you frame something as an emergency, that is the easiest way governments can shortcut all of the politics needed to understand what legitimate decision-making would be or what just outcomes would be. It is a surefire way to shortcut a focus on justice for the most vulnerable people in climate situations.
This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
People across Washington will be celebrating National Public Lands Day this Saturday. Entrance fees to national parks and other public lands will be waived for the day. The Trump administration continues to attempt to use public lands for resource extraction, meanwhile cutting their budgets. Farah Siddiqui has more.
This Saturday is National Public Lands Day, meaning all national parks, forests, and other public lands in Washington state and across the country offer free admission. Public lands continue to face threats under the Trump administration, including increased resource extraction, funding cuts, and workforce reductions. In the face of these challenges, Devin O'Day of Black Country Hunters and Anglers says celebrating victories is especially important. He points to last June when a measure to sell off public lands was defeated in Congress.
We were able to defend against the large-scale sell-off of 2 to 3 million acres of public lands. Public lands are our shared inheritance. They're something that everyone in America owns and that everyone has a right to access.
According to the Bureau of Land Management, National Public Lands Day is the largest single-day volunteer event for public lands in the country. Washingtonians can join events ranging from habitat restoration to trail cleanups all over the state. O'Day says public land sales were removed from the federal budget reconciliation.